Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, we are approaching rapidly the end of the 111th Congress.
I think we're approaching the end of Bernie Sanders' speech.
I think we're approaching the end of Washington politics as we know it.
Well, if we're talking about a Democratic majority in the House, we are approaching that because once this lame duck session is over and January 5th, 2011 arrives, we have Speaker John Boehner and we have a huge Republican majority.
And
six more Senate seats for the Republicans.
Although, you know, one could argue it's hard to tell the difference, but we'll get to the Senate in a moment. Let's dwell for a moment on the departure of this large Democratic majority in the 111th Congress. They are being asked to do something rather extraordinary. In their waning hours, not only did they get their heads handed to them on November 2nd, but now in this lame duck session, they are being asked to cast essentially their final votes as the majority in the House after 4 years on extremely distasteful legislation for them, essentially extending the tax cuts that they always intended to kill for the top 2-3% of incomes in the country, and also extending the estate tax favorable treatment that was well beyond anything that was contemplated in the previous Bush-era cuts in the estate tax. That's a bitter pill, and a lot of Democrats, a lot of liberal Democrats are saying, I can't believe that this session of Congress is ending with me casting this as my last vote.
What strikes me, though, is that why is it so distasteful to Democrats in the House when you look at the Senate vote to renew the debate, it was 83-15. The final vote was 81-19. Basically, the Senate is on board with this compromise. Both sides did have to gulp and swallow some things that they would not rather have done. But why is it more acceptable in the Senate and so distasteful in the House?
Well, among other things, because the Senate was involved in the deal. The Senate Republicans negotiated with Joe Biden representing the White House, and they were present at the table, and they got their stuff on the train.
But the Democrats in the Senate, though?
Well, the Democrats in the Senate are in a position where they understand just how over a barrel they are to the Republican minority because the Republican minority is unified enough. All they have to be is unified enough to sustain the threat to really filibuster, that is to say, block a bill from coming to consideration on the floor at all, and they prevail. And they have prevailed steadily since the financial re-reg bill was passed last spring.
And if the Democrats try to play that game on their behalf, if President Obama and the Democrats said, sorry, we're not going to pass this, we're not going to extend the Bush tax cuts, they would come out losers again on that end as well.
Because on the assumption. Go ahead.
I was going to say, because they'd be seen as people raising taxes.
Right. And if there's one thing that's well settled in the public imagination about our politics, it is that by and large, the Democrats favor having government and favor having government have enough money to do what it does. And Republicans are skeptical of having government and would like to lean down the diet of the federal government as much as they possibly can. And they, of course, love to cut taxes.
President Clinton had a Republican Senate, and yet he never did the woe is me, this is the best deal I can get. I'll work out a deal, and maybe I'll play the Democrats against the Republicans. But it doesn't seem like President Obama has the kind of political smarts, at least, that Bill Clinton did.
Well, I also think the big difference between the Republican Senate that Bill Clinton had to deal with and this one is that that Republican Senate had some diversity of opinion and people who were willing to go their own way and moderates, even some liberals, if you will,
left. What's that?
And this Republican Senate has largely purged itself of any such people. Those who remain who might have had those sympathies, I mean, Arlen Specter is there, but he's now a Democrat. The two women from Maine are there, but they're now voting with the rest of the Republicans. They have all joined this group of 42 who are willing to say, since we have more than 40, we can sustain the threat to filibuster. Nothing moves without our approval. And that is running the Senate, not Harry Reid. If you spend any time watching the floor of the Senate, you realize the degree to which Harry Reid is not in control of anything that goes on there.
If the Republicans are controlling the Senate in the waning days of the 111th, what do they do when they have 47 votes in the 112th Congress? I mean, then
more of the same.
More of the same and more guaranteed a victory.
And they can also issue some free passes. For example, Olympia Snowe may wish, since she's coming up for re-election, she may wish to have some free passes to vote her conscience or her constituency or whatever in the next Congress. There may be some other Republicans. Scott Brown, for example, has to face the voters again in Massachusetts in 2012. He may want a free pass a few times in the next Congress.
Let me interrupt you for 1 second, because both Olympia Snowe and Scott Brown, by getting those free passes, they could also face a Tea Party challenge for renomination.
That's right. I think in both cases, they probably will face a Tea Party challenge, at least of some strength. It may not be strong enough to really exercise them in the primary. But there appear to be several different Tea Party factions in the state of Maine that can't quite agree on a candidate yet against Olympia Snowe. That could help her, insulate her against such a challenge. And Scott Brown, I think most Republicans in Massachusetts are going to figure they're not going to get a whole lot more conservative representation in the Senate than Scott Brown, and they're probably going to stick with him. That's just my guess. We'll see how tough the Tea Party movement is. It's possible the Tea Party movement is not as formidable in 2011, 2012, as it was in the last 2 years, simply because it will be looking at a more confused landscape in Washington. It will not be Obamatown anymore. There will not be a march of Democratic legislation to be against. It's going to be a confused and shared responsibility mixed government.
Yeah, I was going to say, clearly we saw in 2009 and earlier parts of 2010, the anger at the government was the anger at the Democratic-controlled government, the White House, both houses of Congress. There is a sense that even though the presidency and the Senate is still nominally in Democratic control, that the House would be Republican control. So if you're angry at the inaction of the government, who do you blame in 2012?
I guess they'll probably distribute the blame. And I expect that the Tea Party will still be very angry at establishment Republicans and very angry at Democrats. But I'm not sure whether or not they're going to have the same sort of fresh force that they had last 2 years. We'll see. They may be a spent force. They may be just gathering their true strength for later tests. That's going to be a big question in 2011 coming up. But to get all the way back to those House Democrats, you were asking, what do they expect at this point? I mean, what would they think was going to be their fate in these waning days? And I'm sure that when they, you know, really take a 3 o'clock in the morning stare at the ceiling and say, well, here we are, they realize that they're pinioned. They have no place else to go. But they're angry, and they want to cast one more vote. And I would not be surprised if in this last waning few days they don't take one more swing. They don't try to make the estate tax much more significant and strengthen it.
That's their argument. They're most unhappy with the estate tax, too generous to the rich. I would think there will be a vote, a standalone separate vote on that. But at the same time, I almost think we'll let you have the vote, but let's lose this vote so that we can get our frustrations out. But ultimately, we have to sign this because we can't jeopardize the tax cuts from continuing.
What I don't see at this point is I don't see the House being willing to vote down whatever the Senate sends back after they've sent their new estate tax approach over to the Senate. I think the Senate sticks to its guns, knows where the math is, knows the polls say 60-70% of the people in the country are okay with this deal. They just want it done. They want their taxes to stay where they are. They don't want them to go up. And they just want the holidays to come and the Congress to go.
We're taping this podcast on an unusual early part of the week, Wednesday, so we still don't know the outcome of several issues that are before Congress. But don't ask, don't tell. Looks like it's on the House floor as we're speaking.
And I believe the House will pass a repeal, a legislative repeal.
Standalone, right? Standalone.
That's right. Just as it is, just no other issue attached. And they're using the language that Joe Lieberman and Susan Collins came up with in a bipartisan compromise in the Senate so that they're sure that this is the one way to do it that has the best chance of getting 60 votes and defeating that coalition in the Senate. Now, it's a little hard to imagine at this point that the Senate is going to deviate from this path it's been on for this one issue. But it appears to be possible that if they get the tax deal done first and they pass the continuing resolution on spending and all other issues are basically resolved and they have moved on possibly to debating the New START treaty, that would be a victory for the White House. They might also have at that point enough freedom for some of these individual Republicans that 2, 3, 4, 5 of them could peel off and vote for Don't Ask, Don't Tell's repeal.
You know, we talk about how polarized the country is, how polarized the Congress is, and yet in this land of no labels, which is the new organization that's tried to make a difference, we do see some give and take in the waning days of this lame duck on taxes, on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, on START. And I assume that that cooperation lasts until the end of 2010.
That's right. I think it dies with the 111th Congress. I think we go back to full combat in January.
Even more so because the Republican Party is further to the right, Democratic Party is further to the left in the new Congress.
That's right. And because the margins are so close in the Senate, no one's going to be able to run the show there. So we'll have a kind of an ongoing brawl in the Senate, unless here and there on some issues, enough people are willing to cross the aisle that you can get to that 60-vote threshold. You brought up the No Labels Conference. And to some degree, I think the main big name who was involved in that was Mike Bloomberg, mayor of New York, potentially an independent candidate for president in 2012, certainly a media mogul who is hiring more and more and more journalists, has just taken a big step into the opinion world of journalism with the creation of something called Bloomberg View. He's hired a couple of pretty good big names, Jamie Rubin, formerly in the Clinton administration, David Shipley from the New York Times to run it for him. I think Michael Bloomberg wants to be a big player in the politics of this country in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, he said regarding 2012 presidential candidacy, and he's always asked this, he said, absolutely not, absolutely not. But of course, that's what you say in 2010, and that's probably what Barack Obama said in 2006 until he changed his mind several months later with Tim Russert in an interview. But I still think it's a pipe dream that we think that, you know, the country is going to get so tired with this ideological warfare that what we really need is a centrist candidate like a Michael Bloomberg. But ultimately, when push comes to shove, I don't think voters are looking for that. If you look at a Republican primary, you look at a Democratic primary, they say, no, that's not what we want. We want to stand up for what our beliefs are and what we believe in. And it's not somebody who's like, you know, the armadillo who gets killed in the middle of the road, because that's where all the
Where the dead armadillos are, yeah. Yes. Nothing in the middle of the road but yellow lines and dead armadillos.
That's what the slogan
James
was.
Hightower.
That's right.
Of Texas. But I don't think actually in the end Mike Bloomberg expects to be elected president. I think what he expects is to play a very large role in American politics, both as a media mogul and perhaps as a candidate if he thinks that's the best way for him to roll because well, possibly he gets in. He's not going to win. He's not going to carry any states except possibly New York. But if he throws
his... He's not that popular in New York City anymore. He barely won re-election.
I wouldn't bet money on it. So I'm just saying, even if he can't carry any states, and of course, Ross Perot didn't carry any states in 92 or 96, either one, even though in 92 he got 19% of the vote, but he carried no states.
That's something. More votes than any other third-party candidate in history and not a single electoral vote.
And that's really the hurdle for a third-party candidate. It's not a question of getting a lot of votes. It's a question of winning states. And until they can do that, they're not legitimate contenders to get in the White House. But if you look at what Ralph Nader did in 2000, an arguable point, but a well-argued point about what effect he had on Al Gore versus George W. Bush, a third-party candidate like a Ross Perot or even a Ralph Nader can make a difference. And I think Mike Bloomberg is playing with the idea of how he might be a kingmaker in 2012.
Yes, but I think by all conventional wisdom, if it's President Obama versus a generic Republican, it is the President Obama who gets hurt by a Bloomberg candidacy. We're talking about some middle-of-the-road candidates, and speaking of middle-of-the-road, I mean, we may actually have a winner in Alaska in the next couple of days.
How remarkable.
Yeah.
Well, the judge has thrown out Joe Miller's case. He's dismissed Joe Miller's case.
Right, and now he's gone to the full state Supreme Court, which will rule this Friday. We'll hear oral arguments on Friday.
Yeah, it is unimaginable that the full Supreme Court of Alaska is going to overturn a generous ruling by a generous judge who entertained this case in the first place when it is on its face, what's the lawyer's term, prima facie, it does not establish a reasonable expectation that the result of the election could be overturned.
One thing I don't think is especially reasonable to expect this year is the return of Michael Steele as the RNC chairman. I mean, was I surprised when he announced again? Yes, I was completely surprised. Do I still think he has any chance of winning a second term? Absolutely
not. He has none, which is why we're all surprised. I mean, all the people who supported him 2 years ago when he won, all the mainstays of that campaign, people like Reince Priebus from Wisconsin and Gentry Collins, who was his political director there on the RNC, they've come out not only against him, they're running against him. They're running against him as candidates against him. So there seems no chance for him to win. What is he looking for at this point?
Well, that's the good question. Everybody says, you know, he must be looking for something. And obviously, they're not going to let him run the 2012 convention in Tampa because that means allocating money. And we know how many Republicans feel about Michael Steele and the allocation of money. He misspent. He wasted money. And when you go back to 2009, remember, Steele didn't win until the sixth ballot. So it's not that he was the overwhelming choice to lead the Republican Party in the wake of the McCain-Palin defeat in 2008. He just managed to outlast everybody else. But, you know, he may have certainly more votes on the RNC. You need 85 to survive the January 14th vote. And he probably has 30, 40 some odd votes, more than anybody else. But enough to win outright on the first ballot? Absolutely not.
Okay, he knows this.
And
so
as there are more and more ballots,
doing?
he loses more and more votes. Right.
No, he's done on the first ballot. Right. And the question then is, Why? Why would you go to the convention? Why would you go to the party meeting and subject yourself to that highly public humiliation when you know that's all that can happen? What's he up to?
Well, I don't know. I mean, somebody told him, or maybe he told himself, or maybe he looked on the newspapers on November 3rd and said, Republicans have historic day in the elections. Republicans pick up great tons of seats in the Senate, in the state legislatures, with governors. Well, I'm the RNC chair. I must have had some role in this. Therefore, I deserve to be rewarded.
All right. Okay. So he is allowing himself to listen to his own ego.
Perhaps.
And think that somehow, miraculously, he can make the case that this had something to do with him, even though the average member of the RNC, I don't think, has any notion to that effect.
But in answer to your question, what is he looking to get out of this? I don't really know, because other than self-delusion, I don't see him getting anything in an ambassadorship.
No, well, they don't have
there's no president to give him an
They have no ambassadorships to offer, but maybe there is a job somewhere. Maybe there is an honorific of some sort that he's looking for that he hasn't received yet. Because this was not just a surprise in the sense that most of the reporting had been to the contrary. This was a surprise on any rational, logical basis.
Speaking of illogical stuff, have you been watching what's going on in Chicago this week? The hearings to see whether Rahm Emanuel is qualified to serve as mayor of Chicago?
Full disclosure, the listener may already know, I grew up in Chicago. I do have a certain amount of identification.
The law says that you have to have full-time residency in Chicago for at least a year before you're going to run for mayor.
A reasonable expectation.
Right. Now, he will argue that, yes, I am in Washington with my family because I am working a request of the President of the United States, but I still have my home. I still pay taxes. There. I still vote in Illinois.
You don't expect your congressman not to move to Washington?
Well, congressman is different because I think his family was still back home in Chicago when he was a member of Congress. But when he left Congress...
You're really seriously going to make it about where your family lives? Is that the measure?
No, but I mean, there was no question about residency when he served in Congress, but suddenly when he moved a couple of blocks to the White House, suddenly that became a major issue.
Well, a couple of things are happening here. Among other things, there is a dispute between Rahm Emanuel and his tenant, the person that he rented his home to while he was supposedly living in it, but also in Washington. And now if you rent your house out to somebody, you're going to have a tougher time arguing that you live there. But in
but
this
he
particular
he sell the
case,
house. He rented
he did
the
not
house.
Sell it. He rented it. Right. And so he maintains that he maintained his residence there. And so there's a lot of personal stuff going on between him and this tenant. And it is an opportunity for his many, many opponents to all gang up on him and claim that he isn't really qualified to be mayor of Chicago. Long story short, he has many, many opponents. That's his strength. They are dividing the anti-Rahm vote. He is the only beneficiary of the pro-Rahm vote. I think he's in the driver's seat.
Well, I agree with you completely. There was a new Chicago Tribune poll that had Rahm Emanuel with 32% of the vote. The closest players were Jerry Chico and Danny Davis, the congressman, with 9% each. Now,
where's Carol Moseley Braun?
She was with 4% or something, and Roland Burris had 2%. The thing is, however, that if nobody gets a majority in the February 22nd election, then it goes to a runoff. So I agree with you. I think Rahm Emanuel is in the driver's seat for the February 22nd primary. But if there is an anybody but Rahm movement building in Chicago, and I still don't see that happening.
There will be a movement. The question is how big.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it would be the African-American / Latino community if they can somehow work together to see if they could move the election into an April runoff, then maybe they have some kind of chance. But right now, I think Rahm Emanuel is the next mayor of Chicago.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week as we look back on some of those who left us in 2010 and maybe look forward a little bit at those we expect to hear more from in 2011 on It's All Politics from NPR.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town. Chicago, Chicago, I'll show you around. Bet your bottom dollar you lose the blues in Chicago. Chicago, the town that Marty Fay could not shut down. On State Street, that great street, I just want to say, they do things that they don't do on Broadway. Say, they have the time of their life. I saw a man, he danced with his wife in Chicago.